listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Erica Wyatt. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and we're broadcasting live tonight from behind Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So if you've been listening to Why We Cook for a while, you may remember that over the summer, I went off to Vietnam for a month in June. I went there to work for a program called Streets International. Streets is a program that was created by a coworker of mine who wanted to kind of give back to the hospitality industry. He'd been working in the hospitality restaurant industry for a really long time and decided it was time to sort of go to somewhere in the world that could use his expertise to help people. So he went to Vietnam and started Streets, which is a program for kids who either come from really poor families or are orphans or who are street kids. And what we do is teach them skills to work in restaurants and hotels, in the kitchen, in the front of the house. And it's a residential program. They have housing and English and all that kind of stuff. And so I was there in June to kind of help it get up and running. And part of my role, I'm sort of the culinary director of the program, and a big part of my role there was and still is to develop a curriculum for the program, for the culinary part of the program. The kids work either front of the house or back of the house for about 6 months, and then they rotate, so everybody gets experience and everything. And while I was there for the month, I started writing the curriculum, but it pretty quickly became apparent that it was going to be a much, much bigger and more complex project than we thought, because it wasn't so simple as to just like adapting an existing curriculum from here for there, because there are a lot of cultural issues and language issues and stuff like that. So I thought it was going to be done maybe by August. I told them it would be done by August. But no, I just finished it today. Yesterday, December 8th. What is it, the 8th? I finished it today, which I'm a little embarrassed about, but it's done. I sent it off to Vietnam. It is 6 o'clock in the morning there now, so they'll be waking up to it when they got it. And the founder of the program, my colleague, thought I'd be done in August, and he was slowly being driven mad, basically, by me taking so long, because he has these private donors lined up for big funding. And they want to fund their grants based on seeing results. And in order to see results, they need something to teach. And anyway, so after many months of delay, I can happily say that today I finished all 100 lessons of the Streets International Culinary Curriculum. It is finished. And it was not easy since, first of all, it had to be in metric. And I'm American. I don't speak metric. Of course, although I understand it and I've learned it, but, you know, of course the entire world works in metric except us dumbass Americans who never adapted it. I remember being in like fourth grade and the teacher showing us a movie about metric, and the announcer in the movie said by 1980, the U.S. will be completely switched over to the metric system. And then who was elected president in 1980? Yes, Ronald Reagan, who I think equated the metric system with socialism. And I remember him making a speech saying that the U.S. will never go on the metric system. So here we are, these idiot Americans still using imperial. The entire rest of the world uses the metric system. So I had to write this in metric. So everything I did had to be converted. It's like when I'm teaching at ICE and I have these foreign students. We have all these foreign students and these poor little foreign students have to come here, learn in a new language, and they have to learn the imperial system and all of its irrational arcana, like teaspoons and pints and cups and ounces and all these sort of ridiculous arbitrary measurements, you know. And they've always thought and worked in metric. These are people who always worked in tens, so it's hard for them. So then I have to write this thing in metric, and I have to write it in English for a group of Vietnamese speakers. So a good example of the challenges in this and why it took so long was when I was doing the baking session, which I just finished this morning. I was talking about cakes, and I wanted to give them two examples, two extreme examples of methods of cake making. So one was a Genoise, which is a very light sponge cake, and one is a butter cake, which we would call a pound cake. But you can't call it a pound cake because they don't know what the word pound really refers to. They might think it's a cake that you take a hammer and pound, or you use it to pound something. So not only do they not know what a pound is, but also these are not people who really generally use a lot of butter in their cuisine, and a pound cake is made with a huge amount of butter. If you don't know why a pound cake is called a pound cake, it's because in the old days, old recipes for it would be a pound of butter, a pound of eggs, a pound of flour, and a pound of sugar, which makes a pretty crappy cake, but that's how it used to be. And that's why it's called a pound cake. So you see how I had to adapt things to make it understandable to these kids in Vietnam. And although not for the Vietnamese at the time, but luckily the French were in Vietnam for such a long time that they actually left a very deep legacy of pastry and baking in the food culture. So some of that stuff is very familiar to them. They have somewhat established of a pastry and baking culture. So it's not that foreign to them. It's not like when you talk about things like oatmeal or tartar sauce, you know, or bagels. How do you explain a bagel to a Vietnamese kid? So it was a big challenge. But anyway, I also had to write these lessons assuming that these kids had no prior knowledge of any food other than Vietnamese food. These are really poor kids from pretty tough circumstances. Like I said, they're either orphans or street kids or very rural, very poor kids. Some of them come from Cham Island, which is this little fishing island. And they don't have the exposure that kids in this country have. Even in the U.S., even the poorest kids have at least a concept or an awareness of different kinds of food and different kinds of cuisine simply because they've been bombarded with media since the day they were born. But in this very kind of small world of Hoi An, Vietnam, you know, for our kids, it was good that they just got something to eat every day. They weren't really, you know, watching cooking shows on satellite TV from other countries. But what's funny is that they all came to the program with really kind of good, solid, basic cooking skills just simply from growing up in a culture that still does all of its own cooking and still really values that. Even the street kids, even the orphans, because in the orphanages, they would all cook for each other. And it was really kind of cool because the first nights that the kids came, we went to visit them in their houses. It's a residential program. And they all make dinner for themselves every night. And they just jumped right in, went to the market, got the food, started cooking. No problem. I think if you got a bunch of 18-year-old American kids together and said, okay, go to the market, get some food, and cook for yourselves, it would be bad. There would be a lot of chips and not much else eaten. So that was pretty interesting. And, you know, the other really big challenge was that, you know, I had to write it in English, and it's going to be taught in English, but it's for a group of kids who have like 20 different levels of English language ability. Some of the kids who had more school have more English, some of them not so much. So we get them into intensive English classes like right from the start in the program. And, you know, they'll all catch up soon enough. You know, they're young enough that they can pick up a language easily.
Like a sponge, if you will.
But, you know, in the culinary classes, they start right away learning in English. So it had to be really, really, really simplified. And that's also a big challenge because it's like you're writing for little kids, but you're writing about sophisticated concepts. And you don't want to sound patronizing, but you have to get the concept across. And a big problem also for us was when we got into things about sanitation because, you know, we're this hygiene-obsessed nation. We love cleanliness. We love to kill bacteria and kill germs and feel like we're vanquishing dirt. And that's causing problems for us because that's why people have so many allergies and things. But how did I instill these concepts of things like cross-contamination or the danger zone or proper hand washing techniques in a place where it's not even considered really a necessity to have a hot water source in a restaurant for dishwashing? Or where everybody feels so much like one big extended family that everybody drinks from the same plastic cup in the kitchen. Whoa. These are things that you know, that happens. It's just how the culture is there. And the founder was just about driven insane by this because he likes things very clean, and he's got a PhD in hospitality management, and he's a consultant, and these are the things that he's really on top of because, you know, it's what he does. So, you know, what we would do at home, what we would do in restaurants here is we'd set out sanitation buckets with bleach solution and clean towels, and everybody would have their own cup and color-coded cutting boards. So we did all of that. We got everyone their own little cup. We wrote their names on them. We did the whole thing. Lasted about 20 minutes. The sanitation buckets were used to store food in. The cups would get put out for family meal, but they'd still only use one in the kitchen. It just didn't go that way. And, you know, you realize that you can't impose your culture on somebody else's culture to that degree. People are going to do things the way they're going to do it. So it was a real learning experience writing this curriculum. I'm glad I'm done. I am very relieved to be done, as I'm sure they are over there in Vietnam. And I'll be going back probably in January, so I'll definitely give you a follow-up from there. Okay, we need to take a quick break, and when I come back, we'll talk some more. You're listening to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network.
O nosso amor não vai parar. E seguir como um rio, como uma pedra que divide o rio. Me diga coisas bonitas. O nosso amor não vai olhar para trás, desencantar, nem ser tema de livro. A vida inteira eu quis um verso sim.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. You can listen to this show live every Tuesday night at 6:30, or you can podcast it now on iTunes and take us with you. If you like the show, too, you can also become a fan on Facebook. Just look for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network on Facebook, and you can become a fan. Let me know what you think, questions, comments, all of that. Happy to hear from you. So in the first segment of the show, I was talking about, oh yeah, and who am I? I'm Erica Wides, your host, by the way. I seem to forget to tell you who I am. That's me, Erica Wides. So anyway, in the first segment, I was just sort of celebrating the fact that I finished this big project that I've been working on, which is the curriculum for this program in Vietnam that I'm involved with, Streets. And you can actually check out their website if you want to learn more about it. It's streetsinternational.org. We're going to be having a big fundraiser in New York in March, on March 24th at the Astor Center. I'll talk about it more as we get closer to the date. But if you want to come by and have some great food and help out a great program, that would be super duper if you showed up. Okay, so anyway, I was talking about finishing this project and the challenges that I was facing with it, and just, you know, how we as these sort of germ-phobe, hygiene-obsessed Westerners come into a country like Vietnam and try to impose our standards onto their standards, and, you know, how it sort of backfired for us. We tried to impose these systems in the kitchen with sanitation and all of this stuff, and it all just kind of went back to the way they always do it, which was totally fine with me, frankly, because it's how they've always done it. It's worked. I've never gotten sick eating in Vietnam. They seem to know what they're doing. It's not an issue. But one night, toward the end of my stay, we all went out for a very seriously hardcore karaoke night. Vietnamese karaoke is not something to be taken lightly. These people take their karaoke very seriously. And it was quite a night. We went out for karaoke, and then a bunch of us stopped at a street stall for a very late night bowl of pho. Pho is Vietnamese beef noodle soup. It's like the classic dish of Vietnam. And, you know, the lady who was making the pho did it the way they always do it. She took her ancient wooden chopping block, took her big cleaver, sliced up a bunch of raw meat, put it in a bowl. Then on that same chopping block with that same knife, cut up some onions, cut up some herbs, anything that was going in there, put it all in the bowl, and then ladled the hot stock over it. It was okay by me because that hot stock, hopefully, was going to kill everything. But my colleague, the founder of this program, looked horrified, which I don't understand because he's been in Vietnam now for ages. And it's the same everywhere there. But it still freaked him out, even after all those months. He's got to just accept that that's how it's going to be. I'm sure by now he's gotten over it. I'll see when I go back in January. So anyway, the curriculum is finished, and I'm happy about that. I'll be going back in January, and I'll give you an update from there. Now, I'm going to completely change the topic. We're not talking about that anymore. And I want to talk some more about what I talked about last week, which was oil. Last week's show was all about kind of lesser used, interesting oils that are out there, either for using for cooking or using as seasoning oils. And I didn't get to a couple of the ones that I had wanted to talk about. So tonight is like oil part two. And actually this phrase, lesser used oils, I like. It reminds me of a guy I used to know who was a linguist who lived in Brussels. And he worked for the EU in Brussels for the Office of Lesser Used Languages, which is, I think, so beautiful sounding, the lesser used languages. I kind of picture them in some filing cabinet somewhere in Brussels, you know, these languages just floundering there. So his job was to go around Europe and make sure that there was funding provided for education and preservation of all the little quirky languages that are spoken in Europe but aren't spoken by very many people, like Manx. You ever hear Manx? It's what they speak on the Isle of Man. Or Cornish, which is spoken in Cornwall in England, or Occitan, which is the language of Provence, or Lap, which is in northern Scandinavia. All these languages that kind of predate the languages that, you know, we think of as European languages, or like Euskar, the Basque language. And I love those. I love that they exist and that people still speak them, and they're so old. And that was his job, to preserve lesser used languages, which I thought was so cool. But anyway, I'm digressing. Yet again, what I'm talking about is not language. I'm talking about lesser used oils. Last week, I mentioned pumpkin seed oil and the lovely guys at Hay River Pumpkin Seed Oil. And they were so happy that I mentioned their product and that I gave such a good description of it that they're sending me a bottle of their first ever pressing of their organic pumpkin seed, which I'm really, really excited to get. So thanks, pumpkin seed oil guys. I can't wait to get that. And I had also talked about argan oil last week, which is this oil that comes from Morocco, from these seeds that are inside this fruit that grows on a tree. And in the old days, the goats would eat the fruit and then poop out the seeds. And then the Berbers would pick the seeds out of the poop. It's not made like that anymore, or so they say. But anyway, I had only ever tasted like the most minute little bit of argan. So I realized this week that I had this old Williams-Sonoma gift card in my wallet that I had never used up. So I went to Williams-Sonoma and they had it. So I spent $40 on an 8-ounce bottle of argan oil. And when I opened it up, I didn't really like the smell that much in the beginning. It almost has this weird, like, meaty smell. But then this morning I drizzled some on, of course, my oatmeal, because I'm all about putting stuff on my oatmeal. And I'd cooked the oatmeal with some pumpkin puree, and it really just came to life. The weird smell kind of burned off from the warm oatmeal, and the really, really intense nuttiness of the oil came out. It's got this really strong nuttiness that doesn't actually smell like any nut you ever know. Well, you may know a lot of nuts, but of any nut that you've ever tasted. And also kind of meaty. And it's a little weird, but it's good. It's pretty good stuff, but it's really expensive. So maybe try it at someone else's house. I don't know, about $40 for 8 ounces. I'd spend it on pumpkin seed oil instead. But the other ones that I wanted to get to are other nut oils, like pistachio oil and walnut oil. And then I also want to talk about coconut oil a little bit. The nut oils are for drizzling. They're seasoning oils like the pumpkin seed, the argan, and other nut oils like toasted sesame oil or almond oil, roasted pecan oil. They're all, you know, used as a condiment, not as cooking oil. They're way too delicate to cook with. And frankly, too expensive. I mean, you wouldn't fry anything up in a pan of pistachio nut oil. You want to think of them and treat them more like really expensive perfume to be used very strategically in small amounts. Because they're precious and they're strong and you can really overload a dish with them like perfume. Too much, not a good thing. And the coconut oil that I'm going to talk about later, I'm actually talking about raw, unrefined coconut oil. Nothing processed, nothing hydrogenated. Pure, raw, virgin coconut oil is what you need to look for. But back to the nut oils. So, first of all nuts are full of oil. Except, which one? The chestnut. The chestnut, not really a nut. Not a nut. I'm not sure botanically what it really is. I guess it's a fruit. It's not a nut. Grows on a tree. Not a nut. It doesn't have a lot of oil at all. Chestnuts are actually very low in fat. So you can't make oil out of them. But you can make flour out of them, which is why in Tuscany and in central Italy and in southwestern France, they have a tradition of using chestnut flour to make things like cakes and pasta and other baked items out of chestnut flour. Because before the widespread cultivation of wheat in Europe, people made flours out of other things. So you can make flour out of things that don't have a lot of oil, because things that have a lot of oil spoil really quickly. Oils cause rancidity. Anyway, so the chestnut's not a nut, but these other nuts are all full of oil. And the best nut oils that you buy are ones that use cold extraction methods, just like olive oil, like extra virgin olive oil. They use a cold press method. Heat will destroy the delicate quality and volatile fragrance of nut oils. And it takes a lot of nuts to make a good oil. But the payoff is really worth it. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about cooking with these nut oils and what they're sort of all about. And then we'll get to coconut oil right at the end. We'll be right back on Why We Cook. Heritage Radio Network. Our show tonight is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I am Erica Wides, your host for the evening. You can listen to these shows archived anytime at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, or you can podcast any of them on iTunes. And of course, you can always listen live on Tuesday nights at 6:30. That's when I'm here, sitting in the studio behind Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. And tonight there's a fire going because it's chilly out and it's beautiful. So I was talking about nut oils in the last segment, about walnut and pistachio nut oil, from specifically the ones that come from southern France, because they're pretty high quality. There are some from California, too, that are also really good quality. But what you want to look for in a nut oil is extra virgin cold press, just like olive oil. And these nut oils are really, really good for you. They're very high in antioxidants. They're very high in vitamin E. And they're really, really high in unsaturated fat. So They're good for your heart. They're good for your cholesterol. And they taste really good. You use them the same way you'd use a good olive oil as a drizzle, not a cooking oil. And they make really beautiful vinaigrettes. And you can finish sauces with them. And just the slightest bit of warmth brings out their perfume. You don't want to heat them up too much. You don't want to cook them. You just want to warm them up. Like perfume, you put it on your skin and your body heat releases the volatiles. And that's how you can smell it. But when you drizzle a really good nut oil over like grilled fish or some other cooked food, the fragrance will bloom and waft up. And frankly, I would rather smell wafting pistachio oil than wafting Chanel No. 5. I think it smells better. It's more appealing to me. Or a little walnut oil over roasted beets with some crumbly cheese. It's perfect. So these nut oils are made in a kind of a very controlled way. The nuts are shelled and then they're very lightly crushed so that they don't heat up too much. And then they get a very controlled roasting just to elevate the level of their flavors and to toast them and bring out the real rich kind of nuttiness. And then they're put between these massive granite grinding stones and they're cold pressed at 3,300 PSI for 10 minutes. That's a lot of pressure, 3,300 pounds per square inch for 10 minutes, only that long so that there's no heat created. And then the oil drains off and then it's put in big tanks and left to kind of relax. And the little tiny bits in there just precipitate out to the bottom and then it's bottled and that's it. And the pomace that's left behind, the kind of, you know, paste and shell and bits, that gets fed to the animals. So it's this like kind of perfect nutrient rich boost for them. Too. Although in Morocco, where they make the argan oil, that pomace is eaten like peanut butter spread on bread. And I just want to get to coconut oil here. We have a couple minutes left. I keep mentioning it and I haven't gotten to it. Coconut oil is really something you'd want to use for cooking, not for drizzling, because it's an excellent cooking oil. It has a really, really high smoke point. It's also really good as like a skin oil and as a beauty product too. But when remember that you want to only buy pure, raw, unrefined coconut oil. Don't buy any processed coconut oil, nothing hydrogenated, just raw, pure coconut oil. So remember about 15 years ago or so when Americans suddenly went all fat phobic and crazy about fat and freaked out and nutritionists and scientists were like screaming at us about reducing our fat intake because they said that it was fat that was making us fat. It turns out it's not really fat. It's like sugar and white flour and refined starches. And all the screaming they were doing was about saturated fat, like stuff in meat and butter, animal fats that are saturated fats. Now, that's a whole other conversation because those fats, even though they're saturated, are only bad for you if what the animal ate was poor quality. If the animals graze on grass, then their fats are much higher in omega-3s and they're good for you. But that's a whole other show. We were also told to eliminate all the palm and coconut oils from our diets, too, because they were considered saturated. Now, those were considered saturated because they're solid at room temperature. But just because they're solid at room temperature doesn't mean that they're a saturated fat. A lot of that research that they were screaming about was funded by the vegetable oil industry. Canola and safflower and soybean, they were the ones funding the research because they wanted to flood the market with their oils and not bring in these imported tropical oils. So as it turns out, coconut oil is probably one of the best oils you can eat and the best oils that you can cook with if you buy the pure, raw, unrefined stuff. You don't want to eat the stuff that's used in commercial food, packaged, processed goods because that is hydrogenated. But pure, raw coconut oil turns out to be this like miracle fat because it's got fat molecules that are medium chain fatty acids. Most of the fats that humans eat are long chain fatty acids. And medium chain fatty acids normally would be considered bad news because that's what most animal fats are. But these are fatty acids that we process in a completely different way, the ones from the coconut oil. And it turns out that they can have a really positive effect on your health. Positive effect on your cholesterol, your triglycerides, protects you from heart disease. In cultures where the primary cooking and eating fats are coconut and palm oil, people don't have heart disease and all the related stuff that goes with it. Now, that may be environmental. It may be that their diet incorporates a lot of other stuff. Who knows? But it seems to have the same effect as eating olive oil does for people in the Mediterranean. And there are all sorts of health claims now being associated with it. Everything from clearing up skin rashes to preventing obesity to reducing inflammation. So who knows? There's a lot of stuff out there about it. I like cooking with it because it has a really high smoke point and it has kind of this nice, subtle, coconutty flavor. So you don't want to use it with everything. But it is really nice if you're cooking fish or certain vegetables. It's really good to use in a wok because it can get really nice and hot. And I also really like to use it to make popcorn. I think it has a really nice affinity for popcorn. And it's also good for frying, like for pan frying, not deep frying, because you'd have to buy too much. You know, and you have to think if that for like thousands and thousands of years, billions of people in Southeast Asia and India have been cooking with this, then something's got to be right. You know, usually people do this and they do it for a reason because it's good for them and they're right. And then, you know, the West comes in and says, oh, no, 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 you should change your diet and you should do this and you should do this. And then everybody starts to get sick. So I think there's a lot to be said for traditional diets and traditional food ways, which, of course, hopefully we're coming back around to because people are realizing how astray we have gone from them. Anyway, in a roundabout way, that's my show about oils, part two. And that's it for oils. Next week, we'll be moving on to a different topic. So have a great week, and we'll see you again next time on Why We Cook. Have a good night.